deal with him. If you complain about him, he'll get so mad that it won't be worth it. Sal was the head chef. He cooked food and he left. He interacted with almost no one. He was a terror, but people figured out how to work around it. This was an independent living home. It was an extremely expensive place to live. These people paid top dollar. They were rich. 3 times a day, they were served in a fancy restaurant by dressed-up waiters and waitresses. They expected everything to be perfect, and frankly, for what they paid, it should be. Lacey's job was to keep them happy. Unfortunately, Lacey had received numerous complaints about the food. Her coworkers begged her not to, but she would have to talk to Sal. Lacey gathered herself and went into the kitchen. Sal was mid-prep. He seemed very busy. Crap! This is a bad time, but it has to be now. Otherwise, Lacey may never work up the nerve to come in here again. Lacey asked him if he had a second, as politely as she could. He didn't seem too annoyed. He wiped his hands on his towel and he walked over to her. Lacey explained in the nicest of ways that the residents complained about his food. She stuck to the facts and made sure that she used the kindest words possible. It's Lacey. She's tiny, she's fun, and she's nice, she's cute. What's the worst that could happen? He punched her. Now, not like out and out punched her, but he punched her. You know how people punch you in the shoulder like, hey, man, how's it going? Well, that's what he was trying to play it off as. She let him know that he would have to do better, and he socked her in the arm and said, no problem, bud. He punched her much harder than he should have. He did this to make sure that Lacey knew it wasn't okay to talk to him like that, to make sure that Lacey fell in line like everyone else. Now, the thing about Lacey is she's literally a bodybuilder. It's one of her hobbies. I'd put a picture in here, but she won't let me. Oh, my God. Yes, she will. Okay, so this is the audio version. What you can't see is Lacey's head on a bodybuilder's body, except it's not like I cut off Lacey's head and put it on a bodybuilder's body. It's Lacey's frickin' bodybuilder body. It's unreal. Okay. Frankly, she could whoop my ass, even though I have a foot and 20 pounds on her. So Sal punches Lacey in her rock-hard arm, and as a reflex, Lacey immediately punches him back, also in the arm, with everything she's got. Now, Lacey can throw a punch, but even if she couldn't, she's got enough muscle to make it hurt without any real form behind it. After she rocks this idiot, luckily she has the wherewithal to say, right back at ya. His face looked shocked. He couldn't believe it. She had rattled his teeth. Lacey sauntered away like a cool friggin' dude. She's not a cool dude. As soon as she's out of sight, she runs to HR. She is 1,000% sure she's going to get fired. She bursts in there and is like, Sal punched me in the arm and I punched him back. If she's going to get fired, she's going to take Sal down with her. The HR lady is used to doing whatever she has to not have to deal with Sal. She's no fool. She doesn't want her ass beat. And this woman looks Lacey dead in the eye and says, well, did you tell him you didn't want to be punched? No one does anything, and they both get to keep their jobs. Hair stuff, or can I put my whole hand in your hair? Oops, I just did.
One lovely Christmas Eve, I was in a department store getting some last-minute Christmas gifts. I was rocking my very cute Afro puff and really feeling myself. I'd already had some compliments as I walked the store, so this was turning out to be a good trip. All of a sudden, as I turn down an aisle, it feels like someone is trying to pull my hair off. What I feel is fingers going into the Afro puff and pulling. I think, is Amber filming this as a joke? Is it my daughter? Why is this happening? I then realize exactly what it was. Someone ran their hands through my hair. Their hand got stuck and they kept pulling, trying to get it out. They struggled, and it's because they didn't know not to put your hand in an Afro. You can't do that. You can't run anything through my hair. Not your hand, not a comb. Nothing. If anything gets put in my hair, or Amber's for that matter, it belongs to the hair now. I feel the hand leave my hair. I turn around, and a tiny white woman is standing there. The woman happily exclaims, oh my God, it's so fluffy. I just needed to feel it. What she didn't think would happen is that she would get her fingers tangled in it. This is why I don't like to wear the puff. It can get messed up too easily. Amber always tries to get me to do it so that we can be twins. Sometimes I do. But I will say, there are too many curious white fingers in Omaha. This lady doesn't apologize at all. I look around and a lot of people have seen what has happened and are watching to see how this whole thing is gonna unfold. Little white lady just keeps talking. Your hair is so pretty. I love it. You know, you people. I cut her off right there. With as much kindness as I can muster, I say, we don't touch people's hair. You don't touch my hair without permission, and I don't touch yours without permission. Understand? The lady nods and leaves. Nothing good ever comes after you people. I had no choice but to cut her off. As I walk away, I see black people are frozen in place all around me. I say to them, I'm just trying not to go to jail today. They laugh and reply, I wondered what you were going to do.
I also have a bunch of good hair stories. Not good hair as in our society considers my hair good because, oh, that's not the case. But good hair stories, like stories about hair that are good. Okay, so when I was 18, it was time for me to get my first job. I wanted to work at a sandwich place with my friend. The sandwich place was in West Omaha, a part of town famous for its whiteness. Mom and Dad warned me that I should get a job on our side of town and that if something happens and you need help, no one will be there. You'll look around and realize that you did this to yourself. I was like, okay, 1957, everything's going to be fine. Besides, I had my friend, a white girl, working there with me. That's when they gave me the best advice I've ever received. You love your little white friends, and they love you, but they have no idea what racism is or how to stand against it. If given the chance, they will leave you high and dry, not because they hate you, but because they can't see what is happening. Okay, so how dare they talk about my little white friend like that? But I'm 18. I have no earthly clue the type of rampant racism that lay ahead in life. They knew that I was about to find out what real racism was. They tried to save me, but it had to happen. Side story. I never went to college, too busy trying to have a career in sandwich making, but our sister Angie, who is now a reverend, went to an evangelical college, and they were so racist that she couldn't stand it. She dropped out. The same thing happened to my niece. She got a scholarship to a very fancy rich kid's school, and they were too racist, so she dropped out. Don't worry, she still has 1,000 more scholarships. She'll be fine. Finding out what true racism is when you're 18 seems to be the rule. Not like silly racism, but like the racism that white people who are only ever around white people have. Okay, so I'm at the sandwich place. It's fine. There's one horrible boss, Fran, and one less horrible boss, LHB. Every time Fran balances my drawer, I'm short. Every time LHB does, I'm fine. Curious. The thing about Fran is she's the type of racist that sees what you have and is jealous. I had a sweet, cute, kind boyfriend, and I'd leave every night to hang out with her other employee, my little friend, without ever inviting her, and I have natural zazz. This hoe could not stand it. Do you spell it ho, H-O, or ho, H-O-E? I've seen both, and I prefer adding the extra E. It just feels more fun. But I bet the most fun way to spell it is H-E-A-U-X. I'm going to try that one day. So, one day, my friend and I are cleaning up at the end of the night when Fran friggin' unloads on me. She says a lot about who I date and how I look, and it ends with this. Your braids are so gross. Why don't you take them out and straighten your hair like the rest of you people do? Now, I'm shocked. The whole thing was so venomous. It was like bullying, but with racist stuff. We knew Fran was a dumpy bully, but racist? That was new. None of that mattered. I wasn't alone. My little white friend would back me up, right? I'll never forget. I looked behind me to my friend for support, and she was just standing there, nodding her head, agreeing with Fran. It hurt my little feelings so bad, y'all. She was my best bud. My parents were right. As time went on, every single one of my little white friends went on to say some insane shit. Not constantly, and not a lot by any means, but stuff that would not fly today. Anyway, I was fired the next day, but I'm so glad I learned that lesson as a kid. Can you imagine learning that at age 30? And I know this book is about Lacey, but one other short story first. A few years ago, I was at my friend's office party, and it was too much fun. Look, I always have a good time at office parties, any party, really. I'm programmed for fun. I'm having fun right now, sitting in this booth, yapping away about horrible stories that keep my family oppressed. So I'm at the bar ordering, I assume, a margarita when the drunkest girl in the world walks up to me. She's a tiny drunk white woman who no one had ever heard speak. This woman is so drunk you can't understand what she's saying. Later, I would see Drunky waiting outside for a cab. She was being held up by another woman from the office while Drunky tried to kiss her and the office woman was dodging her kisses while also holding her up. Later than that, people reported the two of them standing next to a pile of puke. So that's the type of drunk this woman was. But back to about an hour or so before that, Drunky came up to me and talked to me about how much she loved my afro. And I will say it did look especially juicy that day. But before I could move away, Drunky put her whole hand into my fro. The whole hand. Not like touched it or bounced it or patted it, but did a magic trick where she made her whole hand disappear. I start to tell this lady not to put whole hands in people's hair, lest she only be able to count to five for the rest of her life, when she loses her balance. Now again, we are at the bar and she tries to hold on to my hair for support, but it's not enough. With her whole hand in my hair, she does the only thing that would stop her from falling. She holds on to my hair for dear life, and it holds her up. Do you remember the poster for the movie Cliffhanger, where Sylvester Stallone is facing certain death, dangling hundreds of feet in the air, holding on with just one hand to the edge of a cliff? Well, it's the same thing, except my hair is the cliff, and Drunky is Rambo. I have never been prouder of my hair. It literally saved someone. She is so drunk, she doesn't know what she's done. So I grab her so she doesn't fall. I prop her up against the bar, and I proceed to laugh myself sick. It was truly the funniest thing that could ever happen to an afro. Better than the time a dragonfly was trapped in it while I was in line at McDonald's, and I cried until a stranger got it out. Better than when I used to do this bit where I would hide a pencil in my afro and then take it out during meetings. I still laugh when I think about that tiny woman being saved by my strong fro. My hair is a superhero. Oh no, this is the best afro story. Okay, so when I first moved to LA, my friend wrote on a sketch show and he would put me in sketches. It was the coolest thing I had ever done. You get a cool trailer and people would come in and put makeup on you and ask you what you want to wear. So at the time I had a TWA, teeny weeny afro, and I don't know if you're supposed to repeat that. Probably best to not. I walk into the hair trailer and the lady is having a bad time. She tries to cover it up, but I can see it on her face. I sit down in her chair and I'm determined to make her feel better. I get her giggling a little bit and she's starting to calm down. She then looks at my TWA and asks me what wig I'm going to wear. I tell her I'm not going to wear one. I think to myself, how rude that this lady just assumes I'm going to cover up my hair. Gross Eurocentric standards of beauty. I assume that's going to be the end of it, and I am so wrong. This woman freaks out. She's so flustered, she turns bright red and is like, what? You're going to wear your hair like this? Like how? How do you plan on, you mean just like this? Okay, well, I don't know how to, what do you usually, how? And then, hand to God, she starts crying. I couldn't believe it. She looked at my afro and cried. My afro made her cry. You guys, while she sat there and did nothing, I put a headband on and called it good. I was no longer interested in her feelings. I left the trailer. It was not the last time I would have to do my own hair while sitting in the chair of a professional. Okay, next story. Back to Lacey. Once, when Lacey was young, 1,000 years ago.
I'll pinch you.
Please don't. Years ago, it was nighttime, and Lacey was taking the city bus, and when she got on it, the white lady bus driver looked at her like she was disgusted. She was giving her a full scowl. Now, if you're a bus driver in Omaha, Nebraska, I don't know your journey or what you have to go through, so you might just give everyone that look for your personal safety, and I respect that. Sometimes I do that. Lacey taught me, if the sun is down, wear a frown, and I gotta say, it has always worked for me. So, Lacey gets scowled at by this lady and thinks nothing of it until the lady goes, "Geez, you look like you cut your hair with an axe. You look just like Gladys Knight." She didn't mean this as a compliment. This raggedy bus-driving Gargamel was trying to burn her, but ended up giving her a great compliment. Gladys Knight is as talented as she is beautiful, so shut your midnight bus to North Omaha behind up. You'll never believe this one. As we were talking about this story, a complete stranger came up to me and told me I looked exactly like Gladys Knight. Did he have that thought independently? Did he hear us talking about it? I don't know. Do I look anything like Gladys Knight? No. There's this thing where white women like to be loudly grossed out by the way black women look, like our hair and bodies and stuff, and you can always see clean through it. Like, even though they're not saying it, what they're thinking seems to be, this lady gets laid? Men like this? It's like they're actively comparing themselves to you and their coming up short is infuriating. So they try to rag on you, but it never quite works. And now, a section of the book called Pictures of Lacey's Different Hairstyles and What They've Been Called. First, there's a picture of her with an afro. Someone called it cornrows. Then there's a picture of her with a curly wig. Someone called it her real hair. Then there's a picture of her with a straight wig. Someone called it natural hair. Then there's a picture of her with her natural hair, and someone called it a weave. Lastly, there's a picture of her with dreadlocks, which someone has called Medusa hair, worms, Muslim hair covering, these things, and hair hat.
Once, when I had braids, they were called locks by a very woke white lady who cautioned us that we aren't saying dreads anymore, because that term came from Christopher Columbus calling people's hair dreadful locks. Now we just call them locks to keep ourselves moving forward. Please stop trying to educate me on my hair.
History lessons! As we have learned, sometimes something racist happens to you and you don't do a thing. You let people drown to death in a pool of racist thoughts and actions, as is your God-given right. You're only one person. You're not the black ambassador to the United States. If people haven't figured it out, it's their problem. And sometimes you stand up and explain why they shouldn't be doing or saying whatever insane thing they said. Here are a few little stories where, for whatever reason, Lacey decided to help. Lacey loves to tell stories about her family. There are 5 kids, and we have some pretty hilarious things that have happened to us over the years. Oh, maybe the next book will be all fun stuff, like when Jimmy got his head stuck in the crib bars, or when Jimmy got stuck in the clothes chute. He's probably climbing through someone's HVAC right now. Anyway, Lacey was in a meeting talking about how life was growing up with so many kids in the house. One of the directors chimed in and said, "It must have been hard on your mom being a single parent with 5 kids." Now, nowhere in the conversation did Lacey say she was raised by a single mom, because she was not. She told her that she was raised by both of our parents and that they are still married. Now, there should have been an apology from this idiot where she said, "I'm sorry I'm such an idiot. I've been this way forever and I don't know how to stop it." Or, at the very least, that lady should have stopped speaking. Instead, she chimed in and said, "I mean, usually you guys are raised by just your moms." Lacey gave them a history lesson explaining why that's a racist thing to say. Once, they hired a new supervisor at the retirement home Lacey worked at, and you could tell he was not pleased when he met his current staff. He came to the director's meeting complaining that there needs to be more white staff working. Now, that's enough right there. But this man, in front of other human beings, said, "I've looked at the staff, and we have some that are from Africa, and I don't think they can even read. Can most people from Africa read? I mean, having more white people will just make this an easier work environment." Lacey explained how that is inaccurate, let them know the statistics for African immigrants and their grades, and why that's a racist thing to say. All of which was news to him. Lacey immediately reported him to HR, and he was fired shortly thereafter. While working at an Alzheimer's home, you become used to some residents using slurs. Lacey happened to befriend a new 87-year-old resident, and she was very pleasant when they first met. But during Thanksgiving time, her family was visiting her in her room. Lacey walked in to greet them, a room full of the resident's children and her grandchildren. Her face lit up and she said, "Oh, everyone, I want you to meet this N-word girl." Lacey was waiting for her family to correct her. Families always do. They usually apologize with great embarrassment, like, "Oh my God, Mom, you can't say that." And they end up apologizing profusely. But this time, not one person in this room seemed shocked or embarrassed. They all came around her and said, "It's great to meet you. My mom loves you." Lacey immediately gave a small history lesson on how we don't use the N-word anymore. And the old lady never used the N-word around Lacey ever again. Guess which one of those sentences is a lie? When working in management in Nebraska, it's not uncommon to be the only person of color. That's because people think diversity means hiring black people in the lowest positions in the companies, thereby making sure to keep the system that makes it hard for black people to succeed at that company in place. But that's not what this book is about. This book is about a doofus named Lacey.
Amber, you are hard to like.
Lacey was at a director's meeting, and everyone was acting really strange whenever they mentioned the new coworker starting that day. Lacey immediately knew she must have been a person of color because they all kept asking her if she had seen her yet. She had not. They were dying to tell her, but they didn't know the right way to do it. During the meeting, one of the directors could not take it anymore, and finally she blurted out, "There'll be another colored girl working here now, Lacey!" She was so excited to tell her that she couldn't hold it in. Lacey had to give a history lesson on why we don't use the word colored anymore.
My new coworker and I had one thing in common. We were black. Once she started, the staff and the residents at the retirement home could not tell us apart. Every day, people would mistake us for one another. I'm not in any way exaggerating. I'm a good 15 years older than her.
She's 15 years older than me, too.
Shut up. I have natural long locks, and she has bone-straight shorter hair. I was in a meeting with my boss for 32 minutes. 32 minutes. When the meeting was over, she said to me, "Now send Lacey in, because I'm supposed to meet with her soon." I said, "I am Lacey." And we sat there in silence, and then she apologized. I gave a lesson on how not being able to tell black people apart is racist.
Everyone at Lacey's work had to agree on where their annual outing was going to be. Paintball? Olive Garden? Who knows? Everyone voted unanimously to go to the shooting range, except for one holdout, Lacey. Lacey explained how historically, that's going to have to be a big fat nope. After Lacey complained about many racist coworkers, one job required Lacey's whole office to go to diversity training. Lacey was the only one who showed up. I wish Lacey had the phone numbers of everyone in the world because nothing is funnier than the text she sent on this, the angriest day of her life. The next day, she explained to her coworkers why that was wrong. Once, as a lady was inviting the staff to her dinner party, she says right to Lacey, "Hey, Lacey, I'm having a dinner party. Gin and juice, right? Right? We have some for you. Gin and juice." Now, this lady is very fun and nice, but she is as dumb as racism is real. Here's another thing she said that we will laugh about until we die. In order to understand it, you have to know that Lacey, who is straight and was married, drove a small car. She comes up to Lacey and says, "You should date Emily. You guys would make a cute couple because you both have those tiny lesbian cars, you know? The ones that lesbians drive. You know how they drive those cars in that area? You know, there's that one area that's full of lesbians and their tiny cars." Now, lesbians have many stereotypes to choose from, but tiny cars ain't one of them. Subarus aren't tiny, and I feel confident in saying there's no place where lesbians meet up to drive tiny cars. How could anyone have come to that conclusion? In this instance, we learned the history lesson. Lacey once worked at an office where almost all the supervisors were white and everyone else was black. Their boss wanted to congratulate them on doing a good job, so she bought a T-shirt for all the staff who did such a good job that says, #WeWinnin'. The T-shirt was shown in the morning meeting. Lacey asked, "Why does it say we winnin'?" A coworker leans over to her and says, "Because that's how you guys would say it." Lacey sent me this text as I was pitching this book. "Hello, one more thing to add. Our new shirts came today for reaching our goal. I asked why does it say that and was told because that's how you guys would say it." Lacey explained how this is racist. When the person who got those shirts left, Lacey was filled with hope until she met the replacement. He was a bit of a mess. Let's call him Mess. Mess was never a huge problem, but he was definitely one of those people where you don't know what in the world he was going to say next. Like, you could be pretty sure he wasn't going to say anything intentionally hurtful, but you also knew on any day he could say something that would make you have to file a report. So they work in North Omaha. Again, North Omaha is a large part of Omaha with good and not so great neighborhoods. This particular part of Omaha is a very nice part. It's the same neighborhood my rich friend lives in. That's where we're at. It's time for the morning meeting. There are plenty of black employees there. Mess stands up to give an inspirational speech. "I want to make this building the jewel of Omaha. Now, I know it sounds crazy because we're in North Omaha, but I believe that even in this neighborhood, we can make this building look great." He goes on and on, but you get it. All the black people hear this and are giving each other the "can you believe this guy" eye. This fool is so stupid, he doesn't realize what he has said. Lacey's the only Black director. She's going to have to get up and say something. The Black people who work here are in an unfortunate spot because most of our directors are from small towns. We have to tolerate them talking about how they're scared to come to work and how they're scared to walk to their car, even while the sun is up, as if someone wants to steal a 2003 Kia. North Omaha is everything north of Dodge Street. Warren Buffett damn near lives in North Omaha. If he's fine here, I think you'll be fine here. Please stop acting like North Omaha is a bad place to be. We grew up here. Stop talking about the place we grew up, live in, and love with disgust. This was the same place where, on her first day, Lacey looks around and the employees are dressed like you wouldn't believe. The woman showing her the ropes was dressed like she was getting ready to paint a house. Throughout the office, she sees people in torn jeans, sweatshirts, t-shirts. From the directors on down to the mail guy, everyone is dressed like they're about to put on a production of Oliver. Lacey asked why everyone was dressed like this, and would you believe that this lady fixed her face to say, "We dress this way because of the neighborhood we are in. It's very poor and very Black. These people aren't used to seeing people dressed up. When people see us dressed up, it intimidates them. We dress this way so that we can be on their level." She dressed down to be on Black people's level. If she had dressed as fancily as possible, she still would not have been on our level. From where she is, she cannot see our level without a telescope. It was clear this woman had never heard of church. Best supervisor ever! Okay, here's a story about the best supervisor Lacey has ever had. One day, Lacey came into work talking about a new program that gives African children laptops. It's a new kind of laptop that can be manufactured for $100 a pop. A charity made and distributed as many as possible to connect African children to the internet to give them a voice in the global dialogue. Lacey was talking about how great that was. As she was going on and on about progress and how these children can finally be heard and how interesting it will be to hear their stories, the best supervisor she's ever had could not stop laughing. Between his giggle fits, he said, "What are African kids going to do with laptops? What are they going to do with it? Okay, they'll learn things, but what will they do with what they learn?" It ended with him saying, "Well, I don't see the point, and I'm against it." To not understand it is one terrible thing, but to be against it is a second kind of terrible. How can you be against children learning? Two terribles for the price of one in this economy? Of all the supervisors Lacey has had in her life, that man said the fewest racist things. That man who said the fewest racist things out loud had the deepest, most stank racist beliefs just festering in his heart. I'm against it. It's the quiet ones, y'all. And for contrast, here's a story about one of my bosses. A million years ago, I used to work at a comedy theater. Throughout my career, I've worked at a few. I landed this job as an actor, writer, improviser at this place after having a full-time job writing and performing comedy for like 5 years. So I wasn't green, but none of the jobs I had were in this city. So to a lot of people, I came out of nowhere. It was the best learning experience, and I made some real friends for life while I was there. There was a bar across the street we would drink at almost every night. At that bar, there was a Black bouncer who would always be there ready to talk shit and give out hugs. He would always tell me how proud he was of me. It was a magical time. Now, when you work at a regular job and someone says something racist to you, you have to do all kinds of special maneuvers. But if you're a comedian, you can just say something like that again and see if I don't break your leg. Everyone laughs and the idiot gets the point and you can save face. Only the two of you know that you are dead serious. It's great. And because most comedy shows only want one Black person, you make the rules for how Black people are treated. No one's ever going to go, "Well, Marcus lets me call him darky. He says it's funny." That's the trade-off you make. It might be lonely, but you don't have to put up with anything like that for the most part. So we do this show at the theater and it goes really well. So well that the city's big deal newspaper does an article on it. It's going to be a huge piece in the Sunday edition. We go downtown to the office and take pictures at a studio. Fancy. Now, there are 6 people in the cast. The person writing this article divides us into 2 groups to talk to us. We think nothing of it at the time, but the 2 groups they put us in are Group 1, 3 white people. Group 2, me, the gay guy, and the Hispanic guy. I can't remember what questions they asked, but none of them stuck out as crazy or suspect at the time. We end the interview and get back to work and forget all about it. A Sunday or two later, I wake up with a million voicemails on my phone. I immediately assume someone has died. I listen to the first voicemail. It's a guy who works at the theater. I don't know him very well, but his message is something like, "Hey man, I'm sorry about the article in the Sunday paper. That's messed up, and if you want me to say something, I will." Fuck, what in the world does this article say? I get up, get dressed, and walk to the corner store as I listen to the rest of the voicemails. They all say the same thing. I snatch up the paper and head back to my apartment. I find our article and it's cool. There's a million pictures of us and the cast looks happy and cute and in love because we are. I read the article and I get to the part everyone's talking about. It's a quote from one of my castmates that says, "When you're straight and white in the improv community, it takes 10 years to get cast in a show. I think Amber's been here for 12 whole minutes." People were livid, and they had a right to be. Look, even right now, I'm a million years old. I've been doing comedy professionally, full-time, for more than 15 years, and people still want to act like I don't know what I'm doing. It makes them feel better about where they are in life if I only ever got anything because I'm Black. Their own mediocrity never crosses their mind. Frankly, the fact that this guy said that did not shock me or hurt my feelings. At this point, I had known him for a while. I knew who he was and didn't really care. The fact that he felt that way didn't bother me in the slightest. At this point, I had been out in the world away from Omaha for quite some time, making my own way at various comedy theaters. He was not the first to say that to me and would not be the last. Once, a 30-year-old white improviser who could never said to me, "I could do what you do on Late Night with Seth Meyers. I just choose not to." So I thought, well, that sucks, but it's not that bad. It's just one guy. Then I read the rest of the article. The whole article was about diversity. They had segregated us to talk about diversity. What a shitty theater for allowing them to do that to us. What a shitty paper for allowing one of their people to do that to us. And mostly, what a horrible, conniving person that turd of a reporter must be. I hope they find this and understand the fact that they are a bad human being. Before I was done reading the article, I would read a quote from the owner of the theater that would send me into a white hot state of rage forever. I know some casts over the years have not been happy about the emphasis on diversity. There's a feeling that the most talented improviser should get the job, period. But it's also about content. It's also about being truthful to the community you live in. Someone who isn't the best improviser may have a lot to say. This sent me into a white-hot rage. Look, that one guy saying that one idiotic thing that negates my talent is fine. People know him. They know he's liable to say anything. Also, his feeling like that is only a secret to white people. I would have had money on him saying that out loud to my face by then. Hey, whatever it takes to make yourself feel better. But the owner of the theater, in an article about whether or not he should have hired the only two minorities in the goddamn show, insinuates that we aren't talented. This is also something people love to do. They love to act like there are no Black people good enough. No one wants to be like, I've never met a Black person I thought was actually good enough to be in my little show. Maybe I'm a piece of shit racist who can't relate to anything a Black person says, judges them before they've said it, and only thinks Black people are funny as stereotypes. But when they're stereotypes, I look down on them. Honestly, I know this sounds crazy, but there are people who think Black people just aren't good at this. About, like, a ton of stuff. But comedy? We literally use it to survive. I'm doing it right now. Anyway, my boss had shown his whole ass and would need to pay. I call Mom, Lacey, and Angie and ask them how to handle this butthole of a situation. I don't want to, but I'm going to have to talk to this guy. That day, I get two important phone calls that make me feel a lot better. One is from the lady who was in this cast before I replaced her. I made the decision to take this job in part based on the fact that they actually told me I would be cast with her, but when I got there, it turned out I had replaced her. She called me and encouraged me and talked to me about the kind of place it was and what their blind spots were and what they had done to her. She gave me a lot of talking points. She really helped me out. The other call was from our director, who was almost as mad as I was. He assured me that the owner of the theater who said all those things in the paper wasn't even in the room when I was hired. The director also had never heard of that owner being a part of casting a show ever. He had no hand in casting whatsoever. He told me, "I cast you because you're great. You got this job because you were the best person for the job. Now, this really made me feel a lot better. I reach back in my mind and conjure up this conversation whenever I've let someone get to me. Now there's nothing left to do but go have a talk with the owner. I have my talking points and I'm going to be calm and get through to him. I know it's not my job, but a lot of black kids are about to come after me and I need to do what I can while I have some leverage to make sure they're treated right. I would do this for the children. Like Old Dirty Bastard once said, Wu-Tang is for the children. We teach the children. I go into this office for our meeting. My heart is beating a mile a minute. I'm nervous and ashamed and mad, and he starts by immediately apologizing for what he said, and I feel myself start to calm down. He goes on about the history of the theater and all their outreach programs. Outreach programs? Does this man think I'm here to pat him on the back for his work with the black community? He must see my eyebrows change because he starts talking about how last year he was in a really bad place and how hard his life was a year ago and how he's struggling to keep it together. He's trying to get me to pity him. What the fuck does that have to do with what we are talking about? That fucking tears it. I do not need to hear why this man needs my sympathy, and how dare he try to make this about him and his feelings? All this fool had to say was, I'm a crazy poop and I'll try not to be. But he tried to get me to feel sorry for him, and in that moment, all the talking points my mom and sisters told me slipped my mind and I fucking lost it. Y'all, I went insane. I started yelling and I go on for a while. I'm screaming. Among the many insane things I yell at my boss are, do you know how many people think this theater hires minorities to fill a quota? From now on, as long as this theater exists, they can have that thought, look to the owner of the theater for affirmation, and you're dumb enough to have given it to them. You're creating a bunch of white men who feel threatened by my mere existence. We didn't have the word incels then. Anyway, say what you want about this man, but he let me cuss him up one side and down the other. He apologized again, and even though I cussed out my boss, I kept my job. I live in the exact opposite world as Lacey. Ooh, side story. Once, another black actress at that theater was asked out to lunch by the owner, and he started the lunch by saying, so, how's your family in Omaha? And she said, that's Amber Ruffin, not me. She excused herself, went to the bathroom, cried, sucked it up, came back, and was a delight to be around. The two of them had a fun lunch. Now, did he think she was me? Who's to say, but he definitely did. I do not care for these stories. I wouldn't believe these stories either, but hey, they happen. In this chapter, things are about to get gross, y'all. We're going to take a look at some stories that still have me saying, what the fuck? Most of these stories have special surprise endings. I mean, they would be surprising if you heard them anywhere other than this book. We were taught how to handle unfair situations by our mother. She was very Mrs. Huxtable about everything. She always calmly presented idiots with proof they were being idiots and let them trap themselves. It's masterful. She's a very smart lady. She's an extremely intelligent and extremely cool dude. There are countless times I watched her handle a teacher or a furniture salesman who was being racist or sexist like a boss. It was the best way to learn, and unfortunately, a necessary thing growing up in Omaha. I've seen her handle a million situations with grace, but there were four times in my whole life that I remember her really sticking it to someone. Now, you would think that if you spend years and years of your life taking care of your kids, sacrificing, being the perfect mommy, they would bare minimum not write a book that has the four times you were less than cordial to someone who deserved to be punched in the mouth, but here we are. That's why this section is called My Mother, the Executioner. One afternoon, the day before Thanksgiving, I was working on my homework in the living room when the doorbell rang. Now, at this time, our neighborhood was maybe 50-50 black-white. There was little to no crime. My elementary school was great, and there was no reason for me not to open the door. I looked out the window and saw a white woman and her daughter. The woman was 40-something, and her child was a teenager. They were dressed like they had just come from church. I opened the door. As a kid, there's nothing better than opening the door for a stranger. What do they want? Why are they here? Is it dad's coworker? Did we order a pizza? It could only be fun. Now, these people were all smiles, and so was I. I was a kid, and the world was good. There was no way someone would ever show up to your house to deliver racism. The woman had a big box of food, a turkey, canned goods, dessert stuff, treats. It was a huge box of goodies. I looked at the box and was so excited at the thought of free food. This woman said something like, "This is for you. We at whatever church she was from are doing our best to make sure every family has a great Thanksgiving." I took the box from her and I exclaimed, "You're just giving us all this food for free?" Now, what I didn't understand was, sometimes churches go to poor neighborhoods and give out Thanksgiving care packages. This woman and her child came to our neighborhood and thought they were in the ghetto. Our neighbor has a pool with a slide. These people are too lazy to go where their gift might actually be needed. Omaha has real project housing, people who may really need this food, and they decide to come to our neighborhood because it has some black people in it. And some is more than the none they're used to. My mother heard me shout to some white lady about giving us food and knew instantly what was up. She tore down the hallway, snatched the giant box from me, and told me to go to my room. As I did, I remember her saying with a level of disgust I'd never heard before, "You brought your child with you?" My mother continued to enlighten this woman, but is speaking in hushed tones, so I don't know how bad the world is yet, and likely destroying this little white girl's faith in her mom. It wasn't until years later that I had understood what happened. This poor idiot and her kid were pretending to do good, and worst of all, wasting all that food. When I was maybe in third grade, I was really into arts and crafts. I tried a little bit of everything. I loved looking in our children's encyclopedias for different crafts you can do and like the countries they come from and other boring PBS crap. I liked learning about different arts and crafts and what they were called so I could use the word macrame. It never came in handy. I'm pretty sure that was the first time I ever used that word. I would sit in my room for hours with old magazines, cut them up, and then put the tiny pieces in separate piles sorted by color, slather a piece of cardboard with glue, and then make mosaics. It was truly the most fun, and writing this, I realized arts and crafts are what my life's been missing. Google scrapbooking, realizes it's just too much, decides life's full enough. So I came home with this library book, and I was enthralled. It was some old arts and crafts book from, I think, the 60s. So I sit on the couch and I get to planning my next adventure. As I'm reading this book, I come across something I've never seen before. Something called a gollywog. A doll with a black face and big red lips, hair in five poofy short ponytails, and raggedy clothes. I immediately hate the fact that there's a craft I'm not familiar with. I'm a third grade craft expert. How could this happen? And it's presented in a way that's like, everyone knows what this is, and here's our version of it. So I wonder if this is a real thing or if these people just made it up. There's only one person to ask, Mommy. So I go up to her and I give her the book and I ask her about this doll. She's immediately infuriated. This woman picks up the phone to call our elementary school, and a little insight to who Mom is, the school's phone number is memorized. Simultaneously, she opens the book, looks at the copyright date, asks for the librarian. A bit of backstory. My mother has helped out a lot around the school, and I'm the youngest of five, so these people know my mom by now. Perpetual room mother, cafeteria cashier, head baker for all the bake sales, teacher's assistant, PTA president, safe house before and after school. They have to know something bad's about to happen. So Mom gets the librarian on the phone and calmly rips her a new one for exposing her child to racist imagery. She tells the librarian exactly what gollywogs are, where they come from, and what it means to black people. Y'all, if I could have written down what she said to this librarian, I would have got an A in African American Studies. Before she hangs up, she explains what danger the seemingly harmless book puts black and white children in. She takes the book and explains to me that we live in a house full of books, and there are a lot to choose from. I would need to read one of those. This ancient arts and crafts book was no longer an option. My stories about Mom verbally executing people are like these artful, well-thought-out, beautiful speeches she made that have just the right amount of meanness and spunk. I learned so much from watching her shake people out of their ignorance with her words, but once, things went a little differently. I have heard what is known in the Ruffin family as the tale of Disneyland's parking lot. It goes as follows. We five children were in the van with Mom, excited and ready for a fun day at Disneyland, when Mom pulled into a parking spot that someone felt they had the right to. That person was very mad, so mad that they yelled, "Fucking N-word!" He yelled that to a woman in her van full of children. Mom, without missing a beat, flips this dude the bird and replies, "I got your N-word right here, bitch." And this little bitch proved his supreme bitchitude because he drove away silent, scared of a 5-foot-1-inch, 120-pound woman. She then turned to Lacey and Angie, the only ones who heard that, and said, "Don't tell your father I did that." Which brings us to an unexpected part of this book called Your Options. Your options! When you're in a racist situation, you have many options. It always depends on what situation you're in, what they've said, who's with you, and how far you are away from home. Your safety comes first, so sometimes it seems as though you're making a crazy decision, but what you're really doing is staying safe. Here are some of your options. You can do nothing. Doing nothing is always fun. You can just let whatever racist thing happen. The person looks you dead in the eye after having said some nutso stuff, and unbothered, you return their gaze, forcing them to think you haven't been listening. If done right, it can be pretty fun. You can walk away. This one's one of my favorites. When someone says something crazy nowadays, I like to, mid-sentence, walk away and never return. You can also wait till they're done speaking and hold eye contact. They'll expect you to start talking, but you never do. In fact, you leave. You can calmly talk to the person and hope they'll see your side of things. This is for religious people or young, good people who are full of life, laughter, and love. I don't do this anymore, so Godspeed. You can expose them for the dumbass they are. This can simply be accomplished by telling the truth. I think it's the most common thing to do. It's still fun, and you don't have to feel like you acquiesced. You can hurt their feelings. They really cross the line, or you're drunk, or you have just had it. And this is the risk people run when they say something racist. They don't know where they fall on the list of dumb racist stuff you've heard that day. This could be the first or the 40th thing. And because eating shit is bad for you, if it happens frequently enough, at some point you're just going to snap on a racist. The good thing about it is it's a moment they learn from and will likely never forget. And you are always completely justified. You can invite them to make their words match their actions or back the fuck off. Now, when people say the N-word, they're looking for something. You might feel like giving them what they're looking for. Now, this last option comes in handy more than you would think. See, when you're a little nicely put together black lady, a lot of people think that you are to be messed with. They think that they can bring their racism to you so that they can get the high of being a big, bad supremacist. They think that you can be played, and if you shy away from them, they might just see how far they can push you. It's like handling a bully at school. Sometimes the way to not get your ass beat is to demand a person fight you. And when they realize they are too big of a wimp to do that, they understand the world a little bit better. In some ways, it's more helpful than calmly talking to them. My dad is going to be so disappointed at the amount of foul language in this book. Side story, here's who Dad is. He's like the happiest, nicest, most soft-spoken man in the world, which frankly opens him up to a lot of being bothered for fun. Dad likes to take a nap when he gets home from work. He has sleep apnea and is no good without his nap. Whenever he sleeps during the day, I bother him for fun. He's too tired to get up, so he can't get in trouble. It's a great time. I like to knock on the door and serenade him with the same song every time. The hit song, Sleepy Daddy, to the tune of the most beautiful song in the world, Reflection, from the Disney musical Mulan. It always goes like this. I knock on the door and Dad wakes up to say, "Yes," and then I go, "Look at me. You may think you see that Dad is awake, but my daddy's sleepy every day. He sleeps at the same old time. Now I see. If I wake him up, I can have some fun, but it's gonna make him mad." The dad goes, "Amber, get out of here with that. I'm trying to sleep now." So I leave, and then 5 minutes later, I knock on the door, and dad goes, "Yes?" And I go, "I am now in a world where I have to hide my song and how loud I sing it. But somehow I will show my dad just how loud I sing until he tells me to stop." And then dad goes, "Why are you doing this? If you don't get out of here, you are going to get it." So I leave, and 5 minutes later, I knock on the door, and dad goes, "Amber, you better not be." And I go, "Who is my sleepy dad? Is he dreaming? Is he mad? Why is sleepy daddy someone I don't know? And then Dad throws a shoe and he's like, get out! This isn't funny, I'm trying to sleep. And then I go, I won't pretend that I'm gonna stop for bedtime when we'll sleepy daddy show. Sing it, Dad. And he goes, no, get out of here. And I go, who I am inside. Not my best parody, but it's the only way I can get my daddy to go to sleep. And then at the end, I take a bow. And I'm not kidding. After all that, he applauds. He gives me a literal round of applause because the song is over and he feels his child did a good job. Y'all, he can't help it. He's too nice. Anyway, if you're wondering, that's who Dad is. Speaking of Mom and Dad, we aren't going to get into their stories, but I do think I have to tell this one. My parents were both in the Air Force, and that's why our family lives in Omaha. There's an Air Force base in Bellevue right outside of Omaha that they'd been stationed at, and they just decided to stay here. Our parents saw that North Omaha was underserved in many ways, so they decided to start a daycare center. They moved to North Omaha in the 70s and bought an elder care center and converted it into a daycare center. In the basement was a cafeteria, outside was a whole playground, and the main floor was a giant playroom. It was a pretty cool place full of books and toys. Turns out, North Omaha had no other real daycares at that time, so their place filled up fast. It got to the point where almost every Black family in Omaha had a kid there. To this day, people pull me aside and say, are you a ruffin? Your mom and dad used to babysit me. Tell them my family says hello. And then you come home and you tell mom and dad that their family says hello, and they, without fail, go, oh, I remember them. What a sweet child. Just a joy to have around. Now, if a person exists that Mr. and Mrs. Ruffin don't like, you don't want to meet them. So the daycare is going great. Mom and dad are the first daycare to offer flu shots in the Midwest. They figure out how to accept government assistance for childcare, so a lot of parents in the neighborhood can afford them. They really feel like they are a part of the community. They even get a daycare van to pick up and drop off children. In fact, before their daycare van, State Farm had no other such vans in the Midwest. So mom, dad, and State Farm had to sit down and invent their insurance policy. Neat, huh? Anyway, mom and dad are making a lot of money at this daycare, and it's doing quite well. I mean, it's a lot of money. They renovated our house. It was the picture of 70s glamour. Shag carpeting, woven wood curtains, and an orange funhouse mirrored bar. I can't describe it. It was just so cool. They have our two oldest sisters, and things are looking up. After years of success, they have two facilities, 22 staff members, and around 200 children. They're visited by the woman whose job it is to decide which facilities can receive money from the government, Jill Bratcher. She sees mom and dad and their success and is not pleased. During her visit, she looks at the books and out loud says, how could you have cleared this much money? You cleared this much money? She runs the numbers again and again, sure that they've got it wrong. Mom steps away for a second, and when she comes back, Jill Bratcher is cussing at one of the teachers. Mom tells her that we don't talk to our staff like that. Jill Bratcher says, come on, you know you guys use profanity. This woman thinks it's okay to come into this place with Black people and just start cussing at them because we're Black and Black people cuss a lot. Even in a friggin' daycare center full of children. She's crazy. But mom standing up for her employee has made Jill Bratcher very upset. Jill Bratcher works in an office next to one of mom's good friends, Sheila. Later that same day, Sheila calls mom and says she just heard the woman in the next office say, Teresa Ruffin doesn't know who she's dealing with. Sheila and mom have a talk about Jill Bratcher. Mom remembers her saying that Jill was very punitive. She'd never heard anyone use the word punitive about a person. Mom starts getting phone calls from kids' parents saying, someone visited my house and told me I have to pull my kids out of your daycare. Now, 90% of the kids in daycare received government assistance. If the government took them off the list of subsidized daycares, there wouldn't be enough kids to keep the daycare open. But more importantly, there would be a period of time where 200 children had nowhere to go to be taken care of while their parents worked. There are different health inspectors assigned to different zones, and after Jill's visit, when it's time for the health inspector to come, everyone sees it's a brand new guy. Not just any guy, the guy who was in charge of inspecting the boys' home way out in West Omaha. He's famous for giving them failing grades, and that place has the support of millionaires. So mom and dad know what they're in for. This man is visibly grossed out to even have to be here. And even though they never have before, this time they fail their test, but not like over little stuff, over big stuff that would take renovations to fix. Jill Bratcher immediately takes mom and dad's daycare off the list and shuts them down. This woman takes away 22 jobs and leaves 200 kids without a place to go. She could not deal with Black people being this successful. My parents sell it, it reopens later with different owners, and zero renovations. Our parents had 5 perfect kids and great lives. They're fine. The 2 of them are probably giggling right now over a drawing one of their grandchildren made for them. But have you ever heard of such movie shit in your entire life? Every few years, I remember that story and am blown to pieces. I never tell white people that story because they can't frigging stand hearing it. Honestly, they look like they're in pain as they're listening to me tell it and are annoyed that they have to carry this information around with them. I've never been able to understand why white people have such a low tolerance for hearing about racism. I mean, we have to live it. The least you could do is nod your head. The previous and following are just 2 of the many reasons why Black people don't want to talk about race with you. One time, I was talking about some racist something or another with a bunch of improvisers, and this guy gets up from his chair and screams, I mean, screams out of nowhere. Irish people had it worse than Black people. We weren't given jobs and were arrested all the time, and you don't hear us complaining about it. Y'all, a grown man shouted this at me not too long ago. So the grown man's friend is the guy who has a very specific kind of racist tic. Okay, so sometimes there's this thing where white people have lost an argument about a Black issue, and you, just by being Black, become a place where they can relive that argument, and this time say all the things they didn't say before and win. They can win this argument, and this time no one will call them racist or short-sighted. If you're Black and this doesn't sound familiar to you, consider the number of times your white friend has tried to get you to say you like the Beastie Boys. I mean, that alone is 11 million. So this guy loves to calmly start conversations with me about Black stuff and gets mad when I don't say what he wants me to say. It's little, but I see it. It's hilarious, and I love it. He's never, like, very mad. He's always just, like, visibly frustrated. It's all stuff like, can you believe this celebrity said this racist thing type of stuff, and always wanting me to be like, it's okay to say racist things. And, of course, I never do. It's fun. Another thing he does is he uses me to kind of yell at all Black people, you know? He'll say things to me that he wishes he could yell to all Black people. Let me see if I can get you to understand it. So one day, he's talking to me about being a college student, and he talks about how hard it was. And I empathize and say something about how hard it is to not have a lot of money and be living on ramen in good times. He whips around to me and is instantly mad. He kind of yells at me, but like in a hushed tone so no one can hear it. I didn't have a lot of money at all in college, but I wasn't poor. I budgeted smart. Just because you don't have a lot of money doesn't mean you have to be poor. Poor people just don't know how to make a budget and stick with it. And I can't describe it to you, but the way he said that to me was just, you just know he was working through some stuff. People love to get mad at poor Black people when they go out or go to Chuck E. Cheese or drive a car. It's truly the gateway racist talking point. It comes right after, Black people just love me, and, oh no, Black people have started moving into my neighborhood. And he knows you can't budget yourself into upper-lower class. If you could, he wouldn't have said it so quietly, so that only I could hear it. He would have said it in a normal voice. So this guy likes to get in little jabs here and there. He uses me to work through his racist thoughts and feelings. I mean, it's nuts. Oh, I know what it's like. It's like when a guy is sexually harassing you and he'll whisper disgusting things to you so no one hears. And as soon as someone walks in the room, he'll act normal as if he wasn't just whispering to you about his gross wiener. It's a mess, y'all. Men are a mess. I say all this to say, one day, this guy is talking to me about I forget what, but he asked me for my honest opinion, and I give it to him, and it hurts his feelings. It hurts his feelings worse than I intended. Later that day, I end up talking about that story about my parents and the daycare center, and later, he pulls me aside, and in that same uber-frustrated whisper yell, he goes, "That story about your parents? I think they were idiots to let that happen to them." He starts laughing and walks away. See, Lacey? I know some comic book villains, too.
What are you even bragging about?
Yeah, I don't know. Here's a list of head scratchers. In the break room one day, Lacey's sitting with two white female coworkers. They're talking about how crazy their weekends were. One lady really winds it up like she's about to tell the scariest story in the world. I'm on this elevator, right? All by myself, and these two big black men get on. The door closes, and it's just me and these two big black men. She stops telling her story, and Lacey goes, "Well, what happened?" The girl says, "That's it. That's the end of the story." Her big story was, "I once was outnumbered on an elevator." For all we know, she could have been in there with my dad and brother. Her only danger, overhearing a discussion about whether Magneto was the strongest supervillain. Please just say he is. Do not get dad started. Another time, Lacey went to her gas station, the same one she always went to. No one was ever mean to her there. She had honestly never given these people an extra thought in her life. Just normal, Omaha niceness, happy-seeming people. Now, I don't know if you remember this story, but this was a day after a black man named Charles Ramsey helped rescue three white women who were being held captive in a house. It was all over the news. America was so happy to have found these women and so proud of Mr. Ramsey. When Lacey went inside to pay, the gas station attendant was unusually excited to see her, and he said to her, "Did you hear that story about the man who rescued those girls yesterday? See? Black people can do good things, too."
He said, "See," as if I was the one who didn't think black people could do good things, even though I am one and some made me. Did he think I had low self-esteem and Charles Ramsey could give me the courage I need to believe in myself? What exactly was that? You know what? This book is going to leave some people with more questions than answers.
But there really is only one answer.
Racism.
Racism. Council Bluffs Mad Dads. Okay, everyone remembers MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Well, years ago, North Omaha had something called MAD Dads. It's our local chapter of an organization made up of dads who were so concerned that they took to the streets to make sure young kids in North Omaha were staying out of trouble. They were a group of black, tough-talking dads whose television appearances made you feel happy. Like a big group of dad best friends who got together weekly to care about their community and show little black kids that someone was there for them. I forget what the acronym stands for exactly. And a quick Google search has revealed their acronym. Men Against Destruction, Defending Against Drugs and Social Disorder. Lacey was driving in Council Bluffs, Iowa with her two little friends. Council Bluffs is just over the river, but truly in every other sense, miles away. Now, I know I'm from a place that makes people say they don't have black people there, but in Council Bluffs, Iowa, they don't have black people there. So everyone loves to tell you how if you go into Council Bluffs, you have to be careful. So it's 11 p.m. in the middle of winter. It's well below freezing. As three black teenage girls are driving home, the car shuts down and rolls to a stop. Terrified, they try the car again. It goes forward a few feet and stops again. The engine won't even turn over at this point. They're going to have to get out and walk. In no way are they dressed to do that. They check their surroundings. In front of them is nothing and no one. Behind them is nothing. And really far away is a van parked on the street. Next to them is an old building. To their right is a closed restaurant. There is no place to walk and get help. There are no cell phones to call for help. And it won't be long before the car becomes too cold to stand. They get out and put the hood up. Universal sign for distress, right? Their only hope is for a car to drive by and take pity on them. Maybe they could flag them down and the driver would stop and save them. Now, a few things about this. What are the odds someone is going to stop for three black teenagers? Salam. Nothing says that a crazy person won't stop for them, pick them up, and eat them. And, dicey as it is, it's really the only option. So as they sit in the car, remembering their old lives, imagining their funerals where people will surely shake their heads and say, "That's what they get for going to Council Bluffs," they see a cop car in the rear view. Now, they're excited. Surely this means they're saved. Few things about this. That's how you know they were young. To be excited to be alone with the police and no witnesses is, and I say this with love, dumb. They lay on the horn to try to get the attention of the police car. As the car drives by, it doesn't slow down a bit. Several more cars drive by, and they don't slow down either. I mean,